So ladies and gentlemen, it's my pleasure and honor to welcome you in our school, Evangelical School of Theology, EST. It's really a huge privilege that we can today have such a wonderful guest, Sister Teresa Forcades. Today's event, today's meeting is titled Faith and Gender. Tomorrow we'll be continuing this discussion, talk which we have today, and will be culture and gender. And I would like also to invite you for the event tomorrow, which I'm sure it will be really wonderful. Thank you very much for accepting the invitation, for taking time and coming here. You're a special guest here. I know I should be introducing you particularly, but let us stay with just general introduction. We are all friends, equal, one family, whatever, feel like at home. And our doors of our school are always open for you with any occasion, without any occasion. You're always welcome, especially. And today's event is a part of a broader project that is organized by House of Peace Foundation and organized by our school, ESD, and it's called Education, Religion, Culture, Education. And this very event really starts a cycle of four or more meetings with four contemporary, important, renowned theologians: Sister Teresa Forcades, Manuela Kalski, Thomas Bremer, and Micha de Winter. During this event or these meetings, we would like to take a look and really analyze from different perspectives the writings and thoughts of various four famous theologians connected somehow with Wrocław, Breslau, namely Edith Stein, Katarina Staritz, Benno Jakob, and Dietrich Bonhoeffer. And I already would like to invite you for this event. I'm sure it will be really wonderful and important. We'll have this wonderful opportunity to listen to our guests, to learn from them, but also to express our understandings of our contemporary reality. And to say straightforwardly, we'll have this wonderful opportunity to ask a few fundamental questions, not always easy, not always comfortable, the kind of questions that it's really difficult to get away from in our contemporary world. And during today's meeting, we'll be coping especially the thought of Edith Stein and Katarina Staritz. It's a special occasion, as our guest is a special person, Sister Teresa Forcades. And I'm aware that those who are interested in contemporary theology, especially theology in its feministic dimension, and those who read Gazeta Wyborcza, I do not need to introduce Sister Forcades in details. However, let me say a few words. Yes, I have now my lecture. So Sister Forcades, Teresa Forcades, is a Benedictine nun?
Yes.
Yet? Sorry.
Not yet.
I'm sorry, it's my poor sense of humor. I'm not fasting.
Just making sure, because it was clear.
Sorry, I was meaning yes, not yet. A social activist, and she's a graduate of, among others, the University of Barcelona and Harvard University and School of Theology of Catalonia. And Sister Forcades has two PhDs, one in the area of public health, 2005, and the University of Barcelona. The other is 2009, theology. And
Fundamental
theology. 2009 School of Theology in Catalonia. Wonderful. And she's an author of many publications, and among them are three, in my opinion, very important books: Trinity Today, The Crimes of Big Pharmaceutical Companies, and Feminist Theology in History. So it's wonderful. And what I really, personally, what I really appreciate in the attitude of Sister Forcades is her courage and, her openness in dealing with issues that are important in today's world. And they are not always comfortable, not always comfortable for the institutions, and I understand that Sister represents. Well, so Teresa Forcades advocates the independence of Catalonia, now is the leader of the process constituent movement, yes. And she criticizes big pharmaceutical companies for their social manipulations. And I remember a few years ago there was this case of so-called plague or epidemic of swine flu and vaccinations, and Sister Forcades was very much against imposing those vaccinations on countries of European Union. And I think it's important to maintain that our Prime Minister Kopacz was one of those who really refused buying these vaccinations, which turned out to be a good decision. And also Teresa Forcades...
It was proved then that in Poland they had not more cases of death because of the flu than compared to the rest of Europe, and you save huge amounts of money.
Yes.
And
yes.
Some very difficult disease, which is called actually a disease that paralyzes the children, and 800 cases happen in Europe and none in Poland.
My sister also advocates the right to live for every person, but also the right to choose for a woman, and she advocates for the right of abortion in certain cases, and the pill and morning after. And as a feminist, Sister Forcades criticizes. If I'm saying anything wrong, let's just say, but this is how I understand you as a special hermeneutical moment. So she criticized the patriarchal and misogynist really attitude of or the structure of the church, Catholic Church. I would also add that other churches are not finding similar. So as I understand, the sister sees herself under the magisterium, but in the other, well, in the same time, you also said that it's important to see the changes within the Catholic Church, and one of the results of the churches might be ordination of women, mm-hmm. which might be seen as our contemporary European dimension of liberation theology. And The Guardian in 2013 wrote about Sister Forcades as one of the outspoken leaders of Southern Europe far left. I like it very much, and she has been criticized many times also by the hierarchy of the church. But The Guardian also quotes very nice answer of Sister Forcades, that criticisms are to be expected. I follow somebody called Jesus, and he had a lot of it. Appreciate your, again, courage and your fight for the highest values, and I really feel privileged and honored that you are here with us. So can we give a big applause to Sister Forcades? Who is the spiritus movens of this situation today? Yes, it's his initiative and his idea, Vix, that we're meeting today, and the Sister Forcades is here with us. And that in the future we'll have another wonderful theologians. So, chapeau bas, and thank you for your wisdom, for again your courage, and for your energy. Not really giving up.
And cooperation.
And you're not giving up, you know, regardless of the circumstances, which I think it's really wonderful. Okay, so again, thank you very much for coming, accepting invitation. I'm sure we'll have a wonderful spiritual and intellectual feast ahead of us. Now it's time for me to shut up and to give the mic to Edward and Sister Forcades. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, and thank you also for all of you for coming. Is this working?
Yes.
Okay.
Is it? It is.
Nice.
It is.
Rector Szczerba has introduced us, so we can very quickly start with our interview. But also, we preparing our interview, we agreed that we hope that will be that this evening will be a talk with every one of you. So I expect of you that maybe after after half an hour or 20 minutes that you are feeling yourself so free for to put a question to Sister Teresa. And there's also, when it is hard to do that in English, I can imagine that you hear my English is also very horrible. So let us improvise, and also Joel Gernot, he will assist us with translation, because he's like Sister Teresa, very well speaking English. And so don't hesitate, please enjoy yourself in our meeting. It's also necessary to say that we are speaking with each other about religion and gender. Mm-hmm. Tomorrow we will be more concentrated about culture and gender, but also it will not be a very different
divide.
No. And for that reason, speaking, we know we are in Poland. You are in Poland now. This day you came from Berlin, and now you are in a completely other reality. And speaking about gender, we know in Poland that it's a hard item, a very difficult item. But not only in Poland. Last year, there was a United Nations meeting of women, and in that meeting, special delegates from Russia, from Indonesia, and from the Vatican, they tried to change some declarations and to avoid the word of gender. And also, they tried to change, and they succeeded. They try to change the items as abusing women, as homosexuality, and other items who are connected with the rights of every person, and build it on the values of family and marriage and the state and the church, who are defending family and marriage. Mm-hmm. So not only in Poland, but over the world, it's a hard item. And I can imagine myself that between each other, we are having every one of us is having their own feeling about gender. Is it attacking me as a religious person, as a believer? Is it defending me? What do I know about gender? So for that reason also, I want to invite you to take part in the discussion. It is going about us and not about a strange person living on the moon or something else. Sister Teresa, starting now, I told you about what was going on a year ago in New York. Do you think gender, the item gender, the phenomenon of gender, the way of thinking in gender, is that, as many people are thinking, is that connected with an over-accenting individual freedom? And is it, when we are talking and thinking about gender, is it is it attacking the family and the marriage? Mm-hmm. What do you think about it?
Okay, so I will give a Trinitarian answer to this, because I didn't mention my doctoral work in theology is about the Trinity. And to this day, I believe that the Trinity is this fundamental aspect of our Christian theology, or of the Christian theology, that we have not understood yet. And we have not understood yet what it means to have as the horizon of possibility, as the horizon of intelligibility, of comprehension of the world, to have not a stable one, but a dynamic dance, a dynamic interaction that includes freedom and includes, that's the most important for me, and I'll get to your question, I'm just... So includes nine, includes a difference, includes a difference, that's huge change in the philosophical understanding and in the intellectual understanding. We have this long period of pre-Socratic philosophy where the philosophers are trying to find a unity of the world, and they give it different names. They can make the fire into that unity, or the water, or different elements. Doesn't matter the name, but searching for a unity. Later in philosophy, of course, we have different versions of that, and always contemporary to all that, approaches to the reality that realize the diversity is also ultimate, and that oppose diversity to unity. So that's a very well-known phenomenon in the history of philosophy. Well, this Christian idea that you actually cannot separate unity and diversity, that you cannot have the one without the other, and therefore the distinction between unity and uniformity, that's not the same, right? Unity, to be real unity, you need difference, you need diversity. And applying that to the question you were posing to me, for me, it's never enough individualism or individual. It's never, you cannot imagine the life of a society or the life of a family as a middle point between granting the individual its rights and its recognition and its place, and also adapting the individual to the group. That's not how it works in the Trinity, as I am taking that theological understanding. The Trinity, the more you affirm the difference and the individuality, that's a word that theologically I cannot use so happily, but so you understand me, right? The personality of each of those three, the greater that is, the greater is the unity. Am I making the point? I mean, is that being clear? Because that's very important. So we won't get a stronger family by weakening the individual. That's what I'm getting at. And we, of course, won't get a stronger individual by weakening the bond. So that's our challenge, I think, theologically and also at the human level. But I now formulate that from the Christian tradition. Our challenge is, how do I have in my interior, and then how we make regulations and how we live together, to understand that defending the place for the individual choice and for the individual, not only right to express oneself in his or her different, but the duty to do that, that only by doing that we are orienting properly the family or the society. I can give an example of that, which is when I, so make it more concrete, when I entered my community, I've been introduced as Benedictine nun, and I am, yes, not yet, and that it was 1997 that I entered my community, so it will be almost 20 years. I came from the United States. I'm born in Barcelona, but I had gone there to do my training in medicine, in infectious diseases. And I also started my studies in theology there. When I came to the monastery, the abbess said to me, well, what is your expectation in that first year of living in the community that we call the postulante year, right? From postulari, you ask to be a nun, you are not yet a nun, but you live with the nuns, you're asking, requesting to be accepted in the community. And I said, well, I expect to come to adapt myself to the ways of the house, right? Because I'm coming from outside, so my first year should be learning how to adapt myself. And the abbess was disappointed at that answer. And then I was puzzled, right? Because I thought, what did I say wrong? Is that not an obvious answer? And then she went on and explained to me, of course I understand what you mean, I appreciate you wanting to fit in, but you know what, I have a dream for our community. And I believe a Christian community and a monastic community is not a place where people come with very different backgrounds and very different experiences of life and ideas. And as we live together, after 20 years, as it is my experience, then we come to think more and more alike. She said, I don't like this. My ideal of our community is we are a place where people come from very different backgrounds and very different experiences, and as we live together, this originality which God gave to each of us, which is peculiar to each person and it cannot be copied by anybody else, it emerges from within the person, and it comes to be more and more bold, more and more outspoken, more and more ready to assert itself with all due humility, but with all due responsibility. So that, she quoted St. Paul, that's what I think God is expecting from us, and this is a huge duty. So you're coming from the United States, I was expecting that you would help me to do this, and I'm still trying to do that, right? So to help, so in that sense, the short answer, that was the long answer, the short answer is, I don't think that. Although, I must say, of course there are ways to talk about individual that are harmful for the community. Of course, I know about individualism, and I know what it is to educate people in selfish attitudes and to educate people as if I can only take into account who am I, what I want, and regardless of everybody else. That I have also experienced in my community. Sometimes people come that have this type of attitude, and then, of course, that's not, it doesn't help to live together, to put it mildly. So I acknowledge individualism, but no, I don't think that speaking about gender has to be linked to individualism. There are people that, when they talk about gender, they defend individualistic visions, of course, that happened. And there are people that, when they talk against gender, what they are doing is going against the Holy Spirit. I believe that, right? So the word gender in itself, for me, it represents something positive. It represents an opportunity to look critically at something very deep and very important that has been neglected in much of the theology. We're talking about theology today, or faith, so I believe for the different religions, this is a duty to pay attention to, and it's something that cannot be ignored without harming the community or religious community.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Maybe now I have to ask you to give your own vision about gender, so that we know about what we are talking now. I can imagine that everyone of us is having different idea of gender. So can you say what is for you important speaking about gender?
Mm-hmm. Well, when we talk about gender, there is this clear or easy view to explain it as something that takes into account the cultural and the subjective understanding of sexuality, or the sexuation more than sexuality. Meaning that in a first approach, that it needs to be also problematized, but at the first approach you could say there is something that you might call biological sex. This, I said, it must be problematized, because as a physician I could today expose what the difference are between having a chromosomic sex or a gonadal sex or a genital sex. Those are different words, right? Chromosomes, we know about XX, XY, right? And maybe some of you think, at least at the chromosome level, at the genetic level, this is binary, right? People are XX or XY. Well, the answer is no. XX, yes, XY, yes, but also there are other options that are not so minoritary. I'll give the numbers now. But even if they were, even if only one person in the world would be of a different chromosomic or genetic dotation, that would be, for me, enough challenge for a theological anthropology to take that seriously. Even if it were only one person. So what do we want to do? To have that person adapt to our theory, or to have our theory adapt to that person? That's, I think, the Christian answer is, of course, you adapt to the person, right? And you acknowledge that there is a diversity even in the genetic or chromosomic sexuation. But as I said, it's not only one individual, that would be enough, but it's not only one. Of something called XXY, that's Klinefelter syndrome in the medicine, that's one in every 500 newborns. Well, one in every 500 is a lot of people. But as I said, even if it were one, but we are not talking about one person. And we are also not talking about people that you can say, well, they are sick. Well, no, maybe some people are seated here and they don't know it and they have XXY. That has happened, right? Some people don't know it and they have this chromosomic dotation. And there is another one which is X0. X and nothing else. So if we define male and female being 2X, male being 1X and 1Y, So we are living out of our understanding. Many people that have XXY, what are you, male or female? You have two X, but you have also a X and a Y. So what are you? Or those who are X0, what are you, male or female? Chromosomically, there is diversity and there is a difference. But not only that, if we go into the gonadas, it's okay that I go like that?
Sure.
Gonadas, that what it means, gonada, means the ovum or the ovarium or the testicle, right? And in that sense, you might think, okay, that's clear, right? Either you have ovarian or ovaries or you have testicles. Well, also no, there are some cases that have one ovary and one testicle. And again, this is something that might be known, and sometimes it's not known, because it might be cases that I could, I don't want to go that length now, but just to give you a view that the complexity is true and it's there. And again, do we want to adapt the complexity to our theory or the other way around? And finally, of course, genital, you have penis or you have vagina, and you can differentiate in a binary way like that. Yes, for the majority it's true, but here there is even more complexity, even more diversity. And what it is done today in medical practice is, if there is a newborn that has a penis that is less of 2 centimeters, then it's considered that it should be raised as a female. Because it's thought, and that is to this day, right, the medical practice, in some places it's been contested, in the United States particularly, but when I studied in the medical school, my degree is from 1990, that was accepted universally. That's what it would be done. Because it was thought you could not have a male without the penis. So then you better raise that newborn as a female. Am I being understood? Yes, it's clear. And if it had, that actually, I said it wrong, that happened if it had less than 1 centimeter. If it had more than 2 centimeters, it could be a boy. And if it was between 1 centimeter and 2 centimeters, the medical practice is to cut it so that it is less than 1 centimeter. Because otherwise it's understood that this newborn will suffer too much because it won't fit, because it will be either too small a penis for a male and too big a clitoris for a woman. So let's cut it. See what I mean when I say, do we adapt the reality to the theory, or we want to go the other way around? I'm talking reality, I'm talking surgery, and I'm talking real human lives that now are adults and are complaining about it. Because by cutting such an organ, you might cut out also the possibility of experiencing pleasure in the sexual interaction. And this is something that if you want to do, at least you should choose yourself, not being done, because the society has some categories that are so narrow that it will affect your, in this case, not only your pleasure, because it can also have pain and it can also have problems about it. So this is to show the complexity only at the biological level. But then, as you also all might be aware of, comes this consciousness of the own sex. Am I a male? Am I a female? And I'm using male and female because I agree, and it's true, and I think also it needs to be acknowledged that for the majority of people, the binary works. That's a reality. It's not binary, it's nothing, it comes from within nowhere. No, we don't know from where it comes. It's the majority. The majority of people have a binary genetic sex, the majority of people have a binary gonadal sex, and the majority of people have a binary genital sex. And so the majority of people have also binary gender, in the sense that a consciousness, I am a male or I am a female, I'm feminine or I'm masculine. But as you also well know, not everybody. So there are people who having a male chromosome, male gonadal, male genital, and all that society describes as being male, they have a female consciousness, right? And this is transsexualism, sometimes called gender dysphoria, but that's discarded now to call it like this because it's more like a medical label. What happens with this? Are we also gonna say, okay, we don't wanna deal with that, and our theology just goes the easy way and it says male, female, enough, don't give me trouble. No, I don't think so. What means transsexualism for us? And I will now make my theological interpretation of that, right? But first I wanted to set the facts, because maybe not everybody is aware of all the details, right? And then the last one, because I'm talking about sex, then gender, and now desire. It's still another level, right? Sex, I mentioned as biological differences. I already spoke about it. Gender is my consciousness and also the cultural attributes that society gives me, right? So the society, if they have an appearance of what normative male female looks like, will consider me of a female or a feminine gender, but also my own consciousness. And the last divide would be desire. And desire, it's also another level of that, because I might be a female that has all the genitals, all the gonads, all the chromosomes that define the female, but yet, and also have a consciousness of being female, that's the gender, but it has a desire towards female, not towards male. So here we have another challenge for the binary. We challenge the binary on biological grounds, we challenge the binary on subjective consciousness, and we challenge the binary in corresponding desire, in heteronormativity, right? That you desire the person of the other sex is what the binary is supposed to be defending, right? So all this said very quick is the complexity of this issue, and as I mentioned now for the third time, my understanding of anthropology and of theological anthropology is we need to take into account this complexity, and we need to take it into account as it is, which is there is a majority that conform to the binary, but this is not universal. And now comes my theological understanding of this. Well, what does it mean? Why is that just that creation went wrong in some cases? And so some people just don't, are not okay, right? Are sick. Well, that happens, right? They are problematic. They are different, yes, but they are different in a way that's to be viewed as negative, right? It would be better that they would be like everybody else, right? Is that my theological take on this? Well, in some cases that some chromosomic changes cause a lot of problems. Of course, I'm in agreement of calling that a disease and making something as a treatment if possible, of course. But not in all the cases that I have mentioned to you, many of these people I cannot label as sick because they can have a fully fulfilled, happy life with no other problems but the social ones, the refusal of other people. Of course, if they are refused, they are going to have a bad life. They are going to have problems. But wait a minute, what we have to do is not to change the people. We have to change the society so that these people can live in it. My theological understanding is that there is a danger with the binary, which I understand it's there because of the sexual need for reproduction, and this is something that's in itself not problematic. But the danger with the binary is that we limit our understanding of love to complementarity. And that would mean that to love somebody is to love the one that complements what's lacking in me, right? And so if I am, in that sense, a woman, so then with a man we can have a complement in the bodies, but we could also imagine, and in fact, the anthropology of complementarity, or even the feminism of complementarity that the Vatican is promoting in the last few years, exactly, it's based on that, that we have half of the humanity that have a tendency to be more outspoken or more leaders or more to deal with the world, and we have another half of the humanity that actually are to back up the first half, right? And to stay at home or not, but especially to back up, to just devote themselves to the family, to devote themselves to the inner circle. And so the other half can go out and do the things, and that's very stereotypical, right? But this is, to this day, a way of looking into it. Well, this problem with complementarity, I think that it happens because to be a sacrament, and the marriage is a sacrament of the love of God, right? When you have a sacrament, of what is that the sacrament? So it's a sacrament of not the theory of the church, but it's a sacrament of the love of God. And the love of God we find in the Trinity. So the love of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, that also is a love that is towards us in its full potential and in its full capability. The love of the Trinity has nothing to do with complementarity. The Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, the Father and the Son, that's the puzzle of Trinity theology in all the history of theology. It's like they are a copy of each other. What do you mean a copy of each other? No, they are very different, but not different in a way that complement each other. It's not that one has what the other one lacks. It's that you have another understanding of love, which has nothing to do with need or has nothing to do with finding in the other what's lacking in me. It's the same idea, but that's traditional theology, but I believe very important for today. to understand that in Christian theology, God does not need the world. And this we can understand in ways that need to be nuanced, because in Jesus things happen that might challenge that. But you know, in creation, it's not that God needs the world and that's why it creates. This utilitarianism, that's a very important, also challenging cultural thinking today and philosophical thinking. Christianity is radically against that. There is nothing to do with, nothing wrong with using things, but with people, that's absolutely to rule out. So God does not create the world for a need, and he doesn't love us for a need. Therefore, it's inviting us to deal with each other out of gratuity. Graciousness, yeah, this concept of grace or gratuity, I think it's fundamental and the most needed concept in our 21st century. And that is what I believe the diversity in sexuality, at the biological, at the gender, at the desire level, it's a blessing of God. And it's something that God has put in the reality of who we are, so that we can have a living example, a living challenge of what is too narrow in our understanding of love. Because love, to be real love, to be sacramental love, it needs to be dealing with the other person in what one can... Am I doing too long? I'll finish soon, but I say... One second, I stand up, because it's better I don't see you. In a perichoretical way. Perichoresis, yes, is a technical word for the Trinity, right? And it comes from the two Greek words, peri and choreo. So peri is the well-known prefix, round, peri. And then choreo means, can be translated as making space. For example, in the English world, choreography, right, is a dance. A choreography is a dance because choreo graphos is writing graphos in the space, a choreography, right? Mm-hmm. So perichoreo, it means that in the love of the Trinity, if I love you, it means that I am making a space around you, so that you can be what? Whatever you want to be, mm-hmm, whatever you are. So it's not the erotic metaphor for love, which is also okay, and the Bible also uses in the Song of Songs, for example, right? This using the desire that a woman has for a man and reciprocity as a metaphor of how God desires us, how God desires the world. Of course, that can also be used. But what's the problem with the erotic metaphor is that I might desire to go into the other person, or I might desire that the other person comes into me without the consent of the other person. And we know the rape is like that, right? There is a huge desire of being into the other person, but there is no respect for the other person. And so that's why I like especially that the theology and the theological tradition has used for the Trinity that word perichoresis, which means etymologically to make space around. That's the word that reflects the quality of the love of God. To make space around. And if you have an experience of that, if you have ever experienced that somebody does that to you, then you know what I'm talking about, and you know how deeply you can be sure that this is love. Nobody will do that for you for any other reason. Somebody might want you for some other reason. Might want to go into you, or might want that you go into that person for a selfish, needy, or other type of reasons. But making space around you, putting myself at work so that you can be, is like a little bit like in some tribes in Africa or Latin America, when they explain that when the foreigner comes, they go out on the trails and clean the woods, right? Because there it's so exuberant that in a couple of days you also have no path anymore. So welcoming the other by cleaning the path so that that person can walk, but walk, in this case of the path, it has to walk to the town, but I meant to say walk whatever that person wants to walk, right? Am I making sense with this?
Yes.
Okay, because this is my theological foundation of why should the reality be like this? I know that this question often it's non-answerable, but it's licit and we keep making that question, right? Why is it that if the society can accept male and female, why doesn't everybody fit to male and female? It would be much easier, right? why this complication? Why some people are born with all these changes? And we can think, oh, that's because of human problems and radiations. And okay, we might think like this, but it doesn't seem like that, right? You might have, of course, some man-made problems that cause some genetic alterations, but this seems to have been in nature always. And even in animals, there is this transsexuality. Even I had, well, my family, when I was little, had a dog that was a female dog, but she thought she was a male. And how did I know that? Because she never told us that. But what she did is that she peed, is it right? Okay, she peed like a dog. But because she didn't have a penis, she was wetting herself every time. So she just raised the leg, and she didn't like this, but female dogs, they do it in another way, right? Well, what happened to this dog? There are books written about transsexuality in the animal species. So I don't think it's so easy to discard as something that is caused by the sin of humanity. It would be, that's again, to try to fit reality to our skin so that our skin doesn't change and we can sleep at night, right? So there is another approach, which is to say, is it possible that we have to change something of our view of reality? And as I said, what here, I think, it's inviting us in the diversity of this sexual, sex, gender, desire, it's inviting us to do is to broaden the way we understand what is it to love, and even in Christian terms, what is it that makes up the sacrament of marriage. That's why I'm one of those defending not only that the church should be, the Catholic Church in this case, should be tolerant to homosexuality, for example, and should not persecute or not blame or not consider evil homosexuality, but should bless a homosexual marriage, provided, not at any cost, provided, like the heterosexual, that it is a marriage willing to go on with mutual respect and willing to go on with an understanding that the marriage is within a community, right? That's the same thing that we ask for the heterosexual marriage. It's not anything goes. No, anything doesn't go. But the problem is not whether it is hetero or homo. The problem is whether the quality of this love is one that has what it's needed to be called Christian. And the homosexual in its existence is not holier than the heterosexual, but in its existence, and without taking into account the moral quality of that or this homosexual person, by itself, by the fact of existing homosexuality, it's a blessing. Because it's opening up that realm of diversity in a way that I think it's very needed and fruitful for our theological thought. Thanks.
You are giving a lot of...
I went long, but it's because...
No, I was looking through the audience and I understand that we are following you, and I can also say my opinion that we are very grateful because you are giving us the example of what always I call the Procrustes method, to put the reality in my theory and to look for my theory to the reality. And but also I'm very grateful what you thought about the Trinity. Mm-hmm. And that perichoresis, it's in my opinion giving a wonderful opportunity for us in to speak about those things on a constructive and a positive way, mm-hmm. not only against.
But because even here, just short, but even here then the heterosexual marriage, which I don't have anything against, of course, but I would have against that the sanctity of that marriage is placed on the complementarity. I have a problem with that. Mm-hmm. Because the sanctity belongs to God and belongs to what we are like God and what makes us more like God. And it's not complementarity, mm-hmm. with all due respect, because of course I understand at the human level that if I am more outspoken, somebody is more reflective, we can make a good team. Of course that. We complement each other at the human level, but that is practical, but it's not holy. What's holy is that without needing you, I am there for you. That's holy. That's another thing. So when I, not needing you and not having you fill in my lack, right? I'm still there for you, because otherwise, if the sanctity of marriage were exactly this complementarity, then of course what happens when one of the two just loses some power to do that, right? And we know, right? It can lose the cognition with dementia, or it can then the bond is a bit weaker. No, it's not weaker, because the bond, to begin with, the holiness of the bond was, I'm there for you for no reason, graciously, or gratefully, in grace, right? Mm-hmm. And I was going to say something else, but it escaped, but it's on that.
Listening to you, I'm wondering myself, maybe you can relate about it, for what reason the fear, as well in culture as this evening in religious groups, for those, as well for gender as for feministic theology. Listening to you are giving, in my opinion, a wonderful possibility to think about in a positive way about those things. But now the theology of Trinity is well known, the Holy See is provoking fear for the gender theology and fear for the feminist theology. For what reason that fear?
Okay. So here I would like to then mention, if I can do it shortly, that after I've done all this passionate defense, right, of what I think is necessarily the way of looking at this issue that is not narrow and it acknowledges the complexity of reality, but now I would like to develop also what I think is not the right approach to this, which is, well, I'll first defend still another word that has not appeared, which is the word queer, that some people use nowadays as queer theory. And of course, those are only words, and you can just use them and discard them. They are not like people, right? But as I understand queer, I use it, and sometimes I say I do queer theology, and this I use because I think that theological anthropology that I feel it's the more adequate to the Christian message is that one that says, as I said, as my abbess told me 20 years ago, each person is in its or her or his own, it's a unique piece. It's an original concretion made concrete in time and space, the love of God. That's each person, and God loves us like that. God looks at us like that and sees the uniqueness in each person. Doesn't say, oh, female, male, Polish, German, and Jew, and Greek, and lord and slave, and male and female, right? I'm quoting Galatians chapter 3, 28. So why? In Christ Jesus, there is no Jew and Gentile, there is no, there is no lord and slave, there is no female and male. What does it mean, right, this passage? Of course, we have other passages, and now we can start with the war of passages, one against the other, because that's not the only one in the Bible. But let me just say short one. I like to stand because
okay.
I mean, that's a conversation, but I feel it's also,
it's
right?
A conversation.
You stand, so I can see
you. With you.
No. Just short, because when I mentioned some of the biblical passages, I also want to give a very clear example to show how clear it is. I'm speaking about the Catholic Church and the right evangelicals, so you have your own way to deal about it, but the example would be from the Catholic Church. There is no excuse to say, oh, it's in the Bible, because we are already using those passages of the Bible that we think, in our responsibility, communities of the 21st century, inspired hopefully by the Holy Spirit, and not by fear and not by need to adapt to the times, but inspired by what we recognize as the Holy Spirit in the Church, we are already necessarily and have always done a selection of texts. And the example that I use, because it's very striking, we celebrated the Easter, right? So on that most holy night of Easter, in the Easter Vigil, we have the seven readings from the Old Testament. And the last of that seven readings is from Ezekiel, the prophet Ezekiel. That's chapter 36, if you want to then go home and look it up. It's 36, and then from verse 16 to 28. That's the reading. But actually, that's not the reading, because if you look at the Catholic lectionary for that night, it says it will be read Ezekiel 36, 16 to 17a, 18 to 28. So, of course, my question was, what does it say in 17b? 17b is being left out, right? And not only 17, one verse, but it's half of a verse is being left out. What that happened to me actually one of the years at the monastery when I was preparing for the readings, right? Then I noticed that and I thought, okay, I was reading the lectionary directly, so I went to the text of the Bible and I discovered what it says in 17b. And if you look it up at home, then I won't tell you now, so you go and So Ezekiel in this reading is saying, well, my people, right, you have gone to other with other people, right? You have gone in exile, you have gone across the earth, and wherever you have gone, you have defiled me, you have betrayed me. It's that passage where Ezekiel then says, I will turn your heart of stone into a heart of flesh, right? That's a beautiful passage and very important passage. But 17b is when after 17a, God having said that you have defiled me, 17b says, like a woman that menstruates. That's 17b. And the Catholic Church doesn't dare in the 21st century to just say that in the most holy night. Of course not. And I applaud that, right? I don't think we should say that and then say word of God. Just have the whole congregation having heard that in the mouth of God, it's put that you are so despicable as a woman who menstruates. And so dirty as a woman who menstruates. Of course, we don't have to read that. But see my example, we are choosing that as a church. And we are leaving out the passage because we believe this passage, it's not the word of God. We believe this passage, and here I'm using the classical notion of biblical inspiration in the Catholic Church, which is the Bible is not dictated by God. The Bible is inspired by God, who has an unlimited intelligence, unlimited love. That's God. But it's inspiring people who had limited intelligence and limited love. And so the result is something that contains the word of God, but not in every single passage, right? And other people that also have limited intelligence and limited love, also inspired by God that has unlimited intelligence and unlimited love, we do what we can with this text, and we are responsible for doing what we can, and in fact, we are doing that. So this is, in the Catholic Church, not a question, could we leave out? We are doing it. The problem is, why are we leaving out Ezekiel 36:17b, like a woman who menstruates, you defile, and we are not leaving out the woman should be silent in the church? Why are we using that one? Well, it's our choice, so at least know that, right? That we can choose otherwise if we so decide, because we are already doing it. So that was to answer one. To 1 second, because
my question was for what is the fear?
Yes.
Yes.
So yes. So the thing I was going to say is that sometimes with this queer idea that each person should be viewed as an original concretion of the love of God in time and space. But now here comes for me a fundamental point. And the fundamental point is the human plenitude and the human realization, right? That what makes us human and our realizing in time and space being made to the image of God, that is something that we are not born with our final, so to speak, identity. We are born with a potential, right? Here I can quote Thomas Aquinas, or I can quote this classical distinction between image and likeness in the Bible, right? When it says, human beings made at the image and likeness of God. And Thomas Aquinas in the 13th century had used that two words that we know from the Hebrew, that usually they are only the so-called Hebrew parallelism, that uses twice the same idea. It doesn't want to say two things. It's just using it, as we say, very, very good. So, okay, it says the same thing twice. But this had led to mistakes, like when it says that Jesus was, like, mounted on two beasts. Well, that example I don't give now, I don't develop. But you know about parallelism, isn't that archaic, right? Semitic language. So probably that's all it is, right? Image and likeness in the Hebrew original probably only wants to say the same thing twice, so to say very much like God, right? But in the tradition, the theological tradition of this, the Catholic Church, or Thomas Aquinas had used that. He was studying at the time the Aristotelic philosophy of potentiality and act, right? So he used that to say the image is what God has given to each one of us, which we can never lose. So the image of God is our basic identity. That's who we are. It's made to the image of God, which means made, as Augustine had said, Capax Dei. Capax Dei is able to love and able to be free and able to know. Okay, so that's who we are, essentially. Those are words of Thomas Yeats. Now, but whether that will be realized in time and space, that is not a matter of what God does. That's a matter of what do we, of what we do. That's our responsibility, to bring that image into likeness, to realize that potential. Because it is clear, maybe, it is clear to all of those who are here today that human beings have potentiality for love and for freedom. But it must be, of course, also clear that we don't always realize that. And you look around and you see that, right? That it's not love and freedom what it abounds in the world. It's not what we see in every interaction, and even it's not what we do in every interaction, to be loving and to be free. So this realization of a potentiality is what Thomas uses to say the likeness. So the image and the likeness. But there is a space between the image and the likeness, and that space is the space of our responsibility. Okay, apply to gender, because that's what we are talking about. We start, I believe, that's here my position, right, about it. We start, I believe, as children, with a binary. Also, there might be exceptions to what I'm going to say now, and for me, I said before already, the exceptions are not a problem, are a blessing, so we understand to think wider. But my understanding, why the fear, right? That's what I'm trying to answer now. I understand, as children, we have an identity which is called the childish identity, or the, yes, the infantile identity, the child identity, has as a reference point to know who am I as a child. I have a reference point, and that is the mother.
The mother.
This place, this body, and this being in which I have been 9 months, right? And you might say, well, what about if you have been moved from your mother? Okay, but then I take a substitute of the mother. But still, I have a reference which is very, so deep that I now, I'm sorry that I'm going so long, but it's for me very important so you understand how I think about it. I made briefly that some medical experiments that have now very much validated. One of them, it was published in 1989, that's in the magazine Science, Casper and Pfeiffer, if somebody wants to look. This is an experiment done with newborns that were not allowed to listen to the voice of their mother in the first 24 hours after having been born, right? So you have somebody being born and the voice of the mother agreed for 24 hours not to speak to the newborn. And this newborn was given a, how do you say that, a pacifier, right? Pacifier connected to measuring the pressure of the sucking of the baby. Normally, the baby, newborn baby, sucks in what we call a paroxystical pattern, which is the baby is quiet and then suddenly, that's very quickly, right? The sucking, okay, and that was being registered. When the baby did that, which is the normal sucking pattern, the voice, that measurement of pressure, was linked to a recorder that was able to produce the voice of the mother, the recorded voice of the mother. But when the baby was sucking in the normal way, the voice being produced was the voice, if this is baby number one, was the voice of mother number two. If it's baby number two, the voice of mother number three. So not your mother, the mother of another baby. Only when the baby, by chance, did a binary pattern, basically two, and a pause, right? When that happened, the recorder changed and it appeared the voice of that baby. Is that clear, the setting of the experiment? Okay, so that is a clear setting of conditioning, Pavlovian conditioning, yep, in science. Mm-hmm. In less than 24 hours, the majority of the babies learned to suck in a binary pattern. Change the way of spontaneous, and those are newborns, baby, in the first day of life. And in less than 24 hours, they were sucking like this. And I'm making exaggerated, but you see, waiting for that voice. So the conclusion of Casper and Pfeiffer is babies know their mother's voice before having heard that voice extra uterus. And not only know it, but it's a drive for them of a strength compatible of the strength of a piece of meat for a hungry dog, which is the original experiment of Powell, right? Well, I said that quickly, but that's very important because from the moment, and they have said right at the beginning, so none of the arguments that now I'm putting forward for me are to be used to deny this responsibility of women to think whether they want to be mothers or not, and you've already exposed, right, that I have written about abortion, so don't take it in that sense. But my position of about abortion is, of course, not one of saying, oh, yes, abortion. Anybody, any woman who wants to do can do, and that's not a problem. No, I don't think it's not a problem, but I don't think the state should be deciding whether a woman needs to be a mother. My wish would be that every woman, and there are some medical cases where it's your life or the life of the baby, right, and other complicated cases, but if it is not one of those complicated medical cases, and even, because I know some examples, in the case of rape, I would like that every woman would be ready to take that situation that should have never happened, and it would be, of course, fundamental that we do all we can so that it never happens, and speaking about rape, about becoming pregnant without wanting it, take that situation and turn it, because that's the basic dynamic of Christian life. It's like turning something that you have not wanted, that's what God does with us all the time. This is what I would like to happen, but I'm not in favor that the state has the power to put a woman in prison if that woman says thank you for your counsel, but I'm going to do otherwise. See what I'm saying, my position, what it is, right? And also, so because that's an important theme, and I say only briefly, when I was in 2009 denounced to Rome for having voiced my view on that issue, I received a letter saying I should retract, take back what I had said, and then I sent a letter explaining what I'm going to explain to you briefly now, that went to Rome in 2009, and for now, no answer has come. So I don't know if tomorrow I receive an answer, but for now, since 2009, what I'm going to explain to you now has not been deemed or answered with any kind of strife, so I have never been disciplined, right, mm-hmm. by the Vatican. And what I answered, or what I wrote to them is, if you have a father that has a child that needs a kidney transplant, and this is not a theoretical example, only in the United States you have more than 90,000, not children, but people waiting for a kidney transplant. And of course, of those, 3,000 to 4,000 die every year because nobody gives the kidney, right? I even knew in Catalonia an example of a Jesuit that was waiting for the kidney transplant, and let me tell you that not all their Jesuit brothers had offered to give, right? So that's interesting. But 3,000 to 4,000 die every year. Not all of them children, but some of them children. So let's take that case, that you are a father, a Catholic father, you have a child that needs a kidney transplant and can die if the kidney transplant doesn't happen. And you have a kidney that is compatible, right? Okay, that's a Catholic Church. Is the Catholic Church ready to force you under imprisonment punishment to give that kidney to the child? The answer is it's not. That's not happening. I'm not saying, why then? What's the morality behind that? What's the moral reasoning? Why the Catholic Church feels its duty to impose on the mother something that I consider good, which is to just give that birth and to carry on that pregnancy, but what I consider bad is to impose the imposition. Am I making clear here? So why does, under what understanding of bioethics, or better said, of moral theology, is the Catholic Church ready to impose on the mother what it does not require of the father? And my little note that I didn't write on that letter, but that I can share with you now, is nowadays, medically, it is possible to give a kidney even if you are more than 70 years old. So our bishop should start giving the kidney. That's my point. Before you go into a demonstration of people that are pro-life or that are criticizing the women that do abortion as being inhuman, as being assassins, or as being criminals, right? So before you do that, you should, because you can, because many of these banners say, if I could with my body live a life, I would of course do it. So you have a duty to do that, right? Okay, so sometimes some people that have written to me with that, I have answered to them and said, so you know what, even if you are a male, you can do it. You can give a kidney and you can save a life. So and up to now, I have not become any answer of anybody that says, okay, I've done that. So I think it's a hypocrisy, and it goes back to the gospel when it says, you impose heavy burdens on the people and you don't want to move them with one finger. And being clear, I am against, in the sense of considering it something good, against abortion. But I am even more against of having this imposition, that's partial imposition, that's on the mother, not on the father, and that it's made from a position of security that does not even risk your own kidney, because that, you might think, some of you, and I'll finish with that part now, that that's too far off an example, because giving a kidney is not like giving birth. Giving birth is something natural, and you are kept the same, right? Your bodily integrity. Giving a kidney, you are mutilated for life. Well, let me tell you, the mortality and the morbidity of giving a kidney today, first of all, the scar, it's much smaller because it's done by laparoscopy, it's much smaller than the normal scar for a giving birth that's done the episiotomy. And the morbidity and mortality of giving a kidney nowadays is much less than the morbidity and mortality of giving birth in normal circumstances, even more if you have certain risk pregnancies or if you are psychologically distressed because of other issues that might be going on. So that would be my point. I didn't finish with the fear, but come.
Yes, but I will continue my question about fear. So, please feel you free to. Yes, Susan.
Follow-up question to that. You mentioned.
Maybe you can come here, Susan. It's more social.
Just as a Catholic asking. You mentioned Rome and being asked by Rome, and mm-hmm. I guess they are, I don't know how to answer, but when you're speaking here, it feels that you're speaking so freely and you're speaking so lightly. I mean, with the awareness that may be a controversy, but still here it sounds so lightly. But very often here in Poland, in other places, when we discuss those things, there's a heavy burden of discussing as a Catholic theologian. Feminist Catholic theologian with the awareness that whatever you say can be reported to Rome and you may have problems. And we have a list of Catholic theologians and feminist Catholic theologians being already in troubles before and probably in the future. So how do you build your academic career and your spiritual life in the church when you know that you're playing this game all the time? And how do you play this game smartly? Is it a game? Mm-hmm. How to navigate
this? Okay, so yes, I don't know if there is a rule that can apply to everybody, probably not for what I said, but at least from my experience I can say that I consider very important to be careful when I speak, but not careful out of fear, that I don't say that sometimes you have to be smart in that way, but the first carefulness is not out of fear. Doesn't have to be like this. The first carefulness is because what you know is only what you know, right? Your little brain, or I said before, God is unlimited intelligence, unlimited goodness, and not. So that's very important for me, right? So when I talk, I might talk passionately, I might talk, right, with all my strength, but I'm not sure if I'm right. That's the first thing, because I've been proven wrong before, right? And even by my sisters in the community all the time. So that's the first step. And I think it's very important for me to say, listen, this is when I think about it, and that's what I answer also to this. That's a public document, so I can give you this answer, because it's been published. So my first point was this one, to say, in the Catholic Church, I come from a family that's not very religious, right? So when I was little, that was the time of Franco in Spain, I was 9 years old when the fascist dictator died. And my family were not anti-church, but they thought of the Catholic Church as the monarchy, as institutions that are there, but they are like dying, they are like outdated, and you just don't need to pay attention to them, right? So I grew up like that, not thinking against the Catholic Church, but also not paying attention. When I was 15 years old, I read the Gospels, and they made a big impact in me. Why, I cannot explain, but I can say that was like this. I finished reading that, and I was so upset, because I thought, I've lost 15 years of my life not knowing that. Well, that was my experience. So, but then I'm mentioning this because that's what I wrote to this answer to Rome. It's like, I've known the Catholic Church, I've known a stereotype of what the Church was supposed to do, and then I've gotten to know many people that are engaged with the poor and that engage with the situations in life where the people are suffering the more. And I've known the Catholic Church as a place where you can be free, where you can be true to who you are, and a place where nobody will never ask you to say something you don't believe. Another thing is, if I say this is the truth and all the bishops are wrong and all Rome is wrong and I have the truth, okay? Maybe that would be too much to say, but it's not out of fear that I don't say it. It's because I don't think I can say it, and it makes any good to me to believe that I have the truth, right? But it does make a good to me, and I believe I can always stand up to that, to say, listen, if you ask me, because all this happened not because I wanted to make my big point about abortion, or I was on an interview on the TV, and the man there asked me, so what should I say? Suddenly I have no word to say, oh, you're a doctor, and what do you think about it? Well, I'm asked, I answer with what I think, and the Church, official Church, can say, what this woman says is wrong, and I'll accept that. I might say, well, why I think it not, but I won't say, no, you are wrong, I won't engage in that type of thing, because from where can I do that, right? But if I'm being asked what I think about something, I feel, and up to now it has happened, I can come back to the institution, the Catholic Church, and say, wait a minute, what do you mean? That's what I said. They said you have to retract what you said. And what I answer is, you don't want me to say A when I believe B. You're not asking me to lie, are you? Because you're not asking me to do an act of dishonesty. If you are saying, say that you don't have the truth, I'm ready to do that anytime, of course. I don't have a problem with that. If they made me say you are not the one having to set up magisterium for the whole church, okay, where do I have to sign? Of course not, and thanks be to God, I'm not the one, right? It's quite complicated. But if I'm being asked, what do you think about it? It's either I say nothing, which is not very nice, because then people say, oh, the Catholic Church is being irrelevant. Of course, they don't engage with the things, right? Or I'm going to tell you what I think. And you can come up, and even when I speak as a theologian, because I'm not only a Catholic, I'm a theologian, and in question was including the theologian, what I believe I have the responsibility to do as a theologian is to also, for the audiences, especially if they are non-theological audiences, to set up what the official teaching is, right? Okay, the official teaching is this, and then if I believe there are points that I see differently, then I must say them. And I think this is, I know, a discussion in the church is the dissenting, the capacity to dissent in the church, and if you do it in good faith, right? And if you do it in an honest way, even if it's not reasonable, right? It should be, I don't think it can harm the church. I don't have any teaching position, and I might not have any, so if I were teaching in a seminary, maybe I would be ready to risk my teaching position, or I would just have to be careful in the way you said, out of fear, right? So, but I'm not aspiring at a career, so that's a good thing. But the problem I acknowledge, of course. And of course then I think what we should do is to work so that theology can be in the civil university, right? That's a practical point. Because otherwise I'm saying I'm not doing it in a career, but I'm sorry that many young women that I know, they would like to study theology professionally, but then they say, okay, how am I gonna earn a living? So that's a problem. But I don't see that resolved by opening up the seminaries only, which I would like to see, but I'm not expecting that any soon. So I think it would rather be the acknowledgement by the civil universities that theology is a discipline that should be, that actually in the United States is like that, right? That's why Elizabeth Schussler Fiorenza, for example, moved there, because in Germany, as a feminist theologian, she couldn't find any position, right? So
but at this moment, this is I want to put a question, if you allow me. Reflecting about it, what you said and the question of Susanna, maybe one of the last questions, because I can imagine that you are very tired.
But the fear, I'll explain
yes,
tomorrow.
The fear, no,
Because I
am aware that continuously we are speaking about religion and culture. Thinking about those men like some presidents of Indonesia and Senegal and Russia, speaking about Mr. Putin, and also connected with some patriarchal persons from the Vatican who are continuously putting the woman in their role. Then I'm thinking, are we speaking about culture or religion? I don't know. But connecting with your last word about university, thinking about our four famous Wrocławian Breslau theologians, at first, at this time, she was a marvelous theologian, and she was having the guts to think about the position of women as in culture, as well in culture, as in church. Mm-hmm. And she was thinking very provocative. Dietrich Bonhoeffer was also very provocative in his time, not about gender, because it was he was connected with those items. I know there are a lot of professors and theologians now who are connecting, reflecting about Bonhoeffer. But my question is this. There are universities, state universities, also in the United States, so in the Netherlands, where also women can go and study theology. But on many of those universities, they are reading Bonhoeffer and Edith Stein, and they are explaining them in a very conservative way. And they have the right to do that, so as everyone has the right to explain the Bible, and we can use the Bible if we want, open in a progressive or a conservative way. Maybe those words, conservative and progressive, are also not good. But for me, and now I will repeat my question about fear. From what reason people are having that fear against, and let's not only speak about gender, but also about women who are developing themselves, who are thinking critically, and who are given a place for them. For what reason also that universities they are...
Okay. So I'll try to do that short, because my answer to the fear, I've of course engaged with that in depth, and when I explained the thing about Casper and Fifer and the baby, I was preparing the thing, but that takes a bit longer, so I'll do it short. But short would be maybe quoting Yulia Kristeva, that you might know, this Lacanian psychoanalyst that has devoted herself a lot about this topic, and one of her sentences that I like to quote is when she says that we, all of us, male and female, right, and queer and in between, and all the diversities, all of us have had, as a child, the body of a woman at our disposal to satisfy us physically and emotionally. And you might say, well, if somebody has been only geared or raised by a male, okay, maybe not all of us, but the majority, let's say, right? To understand the cultural problem, right? To understand that. Okay, what happens is that as adults, and that's why I started with Thomas Aquinas, with the starting and the whole thing, that we need to change the psychology of the child that has as a reference the mother to move into a psychology of the adult. And the best way I have to exemplify that is with Johannes chapter 3. This is the conversation with Nicodemus, where Jesus says, you have to be born again, right? And Nicodemus, right away, what does he say? Oh, go back into the mother? Is that possible for an adult? And Jesus is like, no, not to the mother, with all due respect for the mother. I have nothing about, right, only respect for the mother and all the role it has, but wait a minute. Adult life is not to go back to the mother, right? So the second birth, the baptism, the becoming a member of the church, it means to orient yourself, not regards the figure of the mother that you needed as a child, and I think that's a starting point for all of us, and I don't think we can abolish that, and it would be good to abolish It doesn't mean that the father should not be more involved in that. That's their separate issue. But in the adult life, what Jesus says is to be born of the water and the spirit, right? This allegory for the baptism, or this reference for baptism. Well, what does it mean? I don't know what it means, but for each of us, it means to grow out of the childhood psychology, to grow out of this childhood where you have referenced the mother, and towards her, you are either like her or not. That's the childish, and that's why for children it's very traumatic. You have a child that is a boy to dress him as a girl, and for a girl it's less traumatic because of society, but it's also traumatic for a girl to have her, unless she wants to, and she's playing with this. Because for children, that's very key for their psychology, to know whether they are like the mother or not. And transsexual children, and that's a very interesting topic to think, together with the queer aspects that I developed before, is that that would be against the people that think that gender and stereotypes of gender are just culturally made. Period. Of course, they are culturally made. I would never contest that, but I contest the period. It's not only culturally made, period. It's culturally made starting with something that I think is trans-cultural, and that's Julia Kristeva also, right here. And what is trans-cultural is that fact that you came out of a body that is called a woman, and it could be called something else, but it doesn't matter. It's called a woman, and certain bodies are supposed to be able to do that, and other bodies are not supposed to be able to. And there are people that look like they could and they cannot, and the other way around. But this easy dichotomy, that belongs to the childhood psychology. And the adult psychology has to move away from this. But to move away, if you know a bit of the Lacanian psychoanalysis or the Lacanian way of thinking about subject and subjectivation, it doesn't mean to go away when you are 18 years old and then you move away from the childhood. When you are 12 or when you are 24. It's not you move away and then you are beyond. You have to move away from the child psychology every time you subjectivize yourself, every time you act. Every time you act, you have a possibility, a dichotomy, which is to act according to this impulse, this inertia that you have from the childhood, or to act in a new way, in a creative way, in a responsible way, in a free way, in a divinized way. This theosis of the patristic theology, we are called to be like God, and God is pure act. God is not moving by inertia. He's making every time something new. It's like a love, and it's like a kiss, but it's never the same one. That sounds very poetic and very nice, but in the practice, we tend to inertia, right? It's like, okay, I kiss that person this way, so the same day, do the same thing. No, that needs to be new. I looked at you the same way than yesterday. No, it needs to be new if I am alive, right? So that sounds very good, maybe theoretically. We are not up to the challenge. And here comes Julia Kristeva again. She thinks, as adults, we generally behave reasonably until we are challenged. Challenged by what? By circumstances that makes us insecure, right? It can be losing your job. It can be like having a defeat. It can be a failure of any kind. And then it's when we have a regression to this childhood world. And in that childhood world, and now comes the point of the fear, the mother is the caregiver. And if you are not careful and move with this inertia of childhood, there is an expectation that is shared by male and female, right? It would be an expectation of the male towards the female, but also an expectation of the female to herself, to take more responsibility for the care, the well-being of the other person. It's like a regressed male would have the tendency to expect for the woman they love that they take care of him, which is not reasonable in adults. But that's why I'm explaining this psychology in ways that are a bit more nuanced. But here's the point. It's not corresponding. The woman, in a regression mode, would also expect her to be the one taking care. It's not expected. It's not the other way around. It's not for all adults going backwards in the childhood. Is I expect you to take care of me, you expect me. No. For all adults going backwards is respect the mother. Who is the mother? Okay, you, not you, you. The one who looks like her, right? The one who is a mother, a real one, maybe the wife, or the mothers in the community, or the one who might be a mother, or the one, right? This cannot be explained so quickly, but am I making sense a little? So the thing would be then, for example, to make it into an example that's more illustrative, the witch hunt. Some people still today think it's a medieval thing, right? Well, it's not that we know, right? The phenomenon, it's not a medieval phenomenon, it's at the beginning of modernity that it happens. In the medieval times, in the 10th century, there is a papacy, Budla or Bula Papal, that says whoever believes in witches, he or she should be condemned because that's crazy, right? How can you have a woman having a pact with the devil and even sexual pact? That's ridiculous, right? That's the 10th century. The University of Paris in the 14th century says there are women who have pacts with the devil and distinguishes between the black magic and the white magic. That's the university who does that. Why am I saying this? Because Zika is one of the ones who has studied that the most, understands that the witch hunt happened at the moment of so-called social anomie, which is a moment of deep social transformation, the equivalent of a personal crisis for an adult that I was mentioning Kristeva. When you have a problem that you don't have resources to deal with as a human being, psychoanalysts and psychologists help us understand there is a movement of regression, right? You go back. And also, little parenthesis, if you have always or ever worked with battered women, women that suffer gender violence, I've done that in Boston, and I've met people who do that in Barcelona and in Japan, and it doesn't matter if it is Boston, Barcelona, or Japan, everywhere, the first most prominent feeling of the woman who has been attacked by a beloved one, you know what that feeling is, right? Do you know it? The most prominent, you are a woman who has been attacked by somebody you trust, you love, your partner, or somebody very close to you. And what is the first feeling or the more predominant feeling that you have? Okay, guilt. Doesn't make any sense. It doesn't make any sense. You should be enraged. You should be upset because somebody has done to you something absolutely outrageous. You should be upset. Why are you guilty? Why is in Japan, in Boston, in Barcelona, why are these women guilty? And the male, when he does that, many times he comes also, at least that happened to me in Boston, he comes with a woman to the place. Because, as you know, this is not a relationship that all the time, it's violent. It's violent and then it's, I'm sorry, I'm going to kill myself if you leave me and I'm there for you. And I'm right, it's up and down, that's one of the problems. Okay, so the man sometimes comes also. And what's the predominant feeling on the man? It should be guilt, right? But it's not. It's rage. The man is enraged, as one of them told me, said, Doctor, you don't have a clue how much I love this woman. If I've done that to her, and he didn't deny that he had done it, it's because somebody has done to me something much worse. Somebody meaning the society, the boss at work, the whomever. So the predominant psychological, intimate, subjective feeling of the male that exerts violence on a woman is rage. Somebody has done to me an injustice and look at what I have done as a consequence, right? And the primary feeling of the woman is guilt. Okay, so that I bring back to this, going back to this in childhood consciousness that makes, otherwise I don't understand that, right? And it's much more complex, but so you see a little bit how I think about it. That if it's true that in the childhood we have this identification, then in so much, and this is not a must, but in so much the adult woman is still identified with the childish consciousness, she will have a tendency to feel guilty if she cannot take care of the emotions of the male that she loves, males and females, but especially the males. And in so much, it's not a must, but it happens. In so much, the adult male is still identified with the childish psychology. He, for more he has studied or PhDs he will have a tendency to expect that taking care of the woman. So here comes my point. The problem with the patriarchal society is the society that says this differentiation in childhood should go on all the life. It's the good thing if it happens all the life. And the anti-patriarchal society says no. That should change in the adult life. Of course, patriarchy shouldn't happen in the infancy either, but you see what it should change in the adult life. It's not patriarchy that shouldn't exist, if possible. It's the consciousness we have. The consciousness of being, identifying our subjectivity with regards to a woman. And that's why in the icons of Mary, like Mary the Mother of God, I love it actually, and I know that from feminist perspective, sometimes that has been criticized, but I find that extremely liberating for that perspective that many of the ancient icons of Mary is doing like this and pointing at the child, right? Like, hey, I'm off the hook, right? Look at me, I'm not the one, look at that. And he's not pointing to a burdened male, old male, he's pointing to a child, right? So this incarnation of the most holy power in something that we consider vulnerable, and something that can be held, and something that is fragile, and something that's countercultural. But also Mary says, don't look at me, don't look at the female, don't look at the mother. Oh yes, the goddess is how nice. Well, not for me, they're not that so nice, because I believe we have a need to break with this idea that the mother is the reference. It's not the mother, it's not the father understood as in patriarchy, but it's this trinity that is a mess. I already said that, right? This trinity that is able to upset and challenge completely, we take it seriously, in a perichoretical way, all our notions. And the more you let this trinity inspire you, so the less fear you will have. But we, unfortunately, have churches and societies that are still living out of the inertia of this childhood paradigm, and that's why I think it's fear.
You give me an answer, not only for what is in the fear, but also how to deal with the fear. Susanne, I didn't ask you, do you agree with your the answer you got from Sister Teresa, but in my opinion what she now told was also a connection, a continuation of your question. I'm feeling myself obliged to finish now, seeing you, at least we need to break, but tomorrow we are on the 2 o'clock in the House of Peace. It is on Roquette Capienne. We will continue our meeting. I want to thank you and thank you, and at this very moment, only I want to say to finish with one short memory in my mind. 20 years ago in the Netherlands, I'm from the Netherlands, I remember I took part in a church meeting organized by a Protestant woman. And for me, as a Catholic boy, it was so marvelous how 3 Protestant women provided the Eucharistie. I know in Catholic tradition it's hard to say that, but for me it was a relief. That obligation is not only on men, but we can share that with women. And those strong women, they showed that. This evening, I saw a woman, a doctor, and a medical euphemist, medicines, and theologian, and you give me a lot of joy, and I want to thank you for that, and hoping tomorrow to talk more. And also, every one of you, thank you very much. And thank you very much, Dr. Schaber, for the hospitality. Okay, you want to say? Okay.
Well, I'd also like to thank him. As I understand, it's the end of the formal part of the meeting, but there is an informal part which might take much longer time, actually. There's a meeting of food and coffee and tea prepared there. So please feel invited.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.